From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. In parts of California, it's another day of what's called critical fire weather. There are multiple wildfires across the state. The most recent is in Ventura County, just northwest of Los Angeles. A brush fire last night quickly engulfed more than 8,700 acres. It's the second major wildfire in Ventura County this week. The Easy Fire started Wednesday. That one's burned more than 1,800 acres. Lance Orozco is news director of KCLU in Thousand Oaks, California. Lance, you were near the site of the Maria Fire. It began about 6 local time last night. What's happening now?
Well, it's at 0% containment, and at this point, we still have about 7,500 people evacuated, 1,800 structures still threatened, but a huge contrast because last night, it was a sea of flames. And to paint you a little picture, the fire started on a mountaintop. On one side of this mountain, you've got a lot of agricultural fields. In fact, I'm standing next to a bunch of lemon tree right now. On the other side of the mountain, you've got a little city of about 25,000 people, and that's kind of an agricultural community. So two different areas, both threatened by the same fire. But what we're seeing now is the flames have subsided. We're seeing a lot of smoke still, because once the fire burned down from the hill, it burned into areas like the orchards where there just wasn't fuel for it to burn. And that was kind of the strategy. They basically said, we're going to let it burn and come down to us, and then we're going to fight it once it gets near the structures. And they've been doing a pretty good job of that so far.
So that was a boon to firefighters then. The fire department issued evacuation orders for about 7,500 people. Were those who were in the fire's path able to escape?
Yes. One of the good things about this fire, if there is a good thing, is the fact that it started on top of the mountain. It worked its way down, and it took a while for it to work its way down, and that gave firefighters a chance to get people out to make sure that they were able to evacuate people safely, and people were able to see it coming. Because it was nighttime, it was very visible. Because it was Halloween, there were a lot of people out, so people got the word pretty quickly that something was going on, and they could just literally look out their windows and see the flames.
Interesting. So despite all this, things like Halloween, I guess depending on where you are, still go on. Kids still trick-or-treat.
Well, the thing is that the fire had started 6 o'clock our time is when it started. So they were kind of in full Halloween swing when this started for us.
Was anybody injured?
At this point, we have had no word of injuries on this particular fire. The other fire, the Easy Fire in Simi Valley, which was about 20 miles away from here, which is mostly contained at this point, there were some injuries in that fire, but they weren't serious ones. And the good news is, compared to some of the other fires we've had here in California, there were no deaths.
That Easy Fire had threatened the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley. Is that right now out of danger?
It is. In fact, that entire community really is out of danger. We expect the containment figure to go up today, but all the evacuation orders were lifted yesterday, so everybody was able to go home. A major highway through that area that was closed, it reopened. And the Reagan Library, it sits up on this hill. There's a lot of brush clearance around it. It's a cement structure, so while it was technically in danger, they were ready for that fire when it got there, and the fire really didn't get that close to it. The pictures were much more spectacular than the actual danger, I think.
We know that the high winds from earlier in the week were said to have made, or possibly have made, the Maria Fire much worse. The air there is still very dry. What is the forecast now? Is it expected to bring any kind of relief?
Well, that's a great question, because there's two things going on. We had the Santa Ana winds all week causing the fires, not just for us, but all throughout the state of California, as you've been hearing about all week long. So the winds have eased off. But in the wake of the winds, the humidity is still very, very low. And so the concern is, even though we don't have the wind, it's still very dry and it's still ripe conditions for fires. And we're hoping to see more of a marine layer, an onshore flow, come into the area this weekend and get the humidity up and really kind of take us out of the fire danger.
Just briefly, you see it up close. You are there. We see it on TV or online. What are we missing?
Well, if you've never been around a fire, I think it can be a little bit scary for people. I've been doing this for a long time, and so I'm sort of used to it. But the problem is, especially at night, if you look up on a hillside and you see the flames, it can be overwhelming. And even people who are 10 or 15 miles away would see it in the mountain, and it looked bigger than life. And so I think it's a very scary thing for people who've never been around it before.
Lance Orozco, news director of KCLU, joining us from the scene of the Southern California latest major wildfire, the Maria Fire in Ventura County. Stay safe, Lance. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, the political ads are already ramping up as we head into 2020, and there's concern about the spread of misinformation through social media, especially after what happened in 2016. This week, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey announced on Twitter, of course, that his social media platform would ban all political advertising. This comes after Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg said his platform would run political ads because he believes in promoting political free speech, even though it may be false. It's a battle of two social media platforms, and let's bring in Femi Oke, who hosts the stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Jeremy.
Well, first of all, how are Twitter users responding to the news about what Dorsey is doing and banning all political ads on Twitter?
There are some congratulations, appreciation, and also accusations that this is a political move. Mark Wilson, for instance, posts, "I do find it interesting that no one had a problem with any of this in 2012. Seems like when the shoe ended up on the other foot in 2016, suddenly everyone got religion on this matter." And then he triggers off a whole debate whether this is politically motivated or really trying to keep the purity of a social platform like Twitter just about the conversation and not about the politics or other people coming in and paying for political ads, whether they may be true or untrue.
Mm-hmm. And Dorsey's announcement, by the way, came just minutes before an earnings call that Facebook did. And so Zuckerberg had to respond, and he defended his decision to allow political ads on Facebook and also said that his decision is not financially motivated. Listen.
"We estimate that these ads from politicians will be less than 0.5% of our revenue next year. That's not why we're doing this. We believe deeply that political speech is important, and that's what's driving this."
How are people responding to Zuckerberg and Facebook on this?
Politicians in particular, because it's almost anywhere in the world there's a political season happening. So politicians in particular using Facebook, because Facebook is such a huge social media platform. They are beneficiaries of Facebook being able to take their ads, and also they're victims sometimes when there are political ads that are untrue. So politicians are weighing in on this. But also, this is a conversation that is so much broader, Jeremy, because it's about social media platforms and whether as third-party providers they are responsible for what is happening on their platform. Mark Zuckerberg is saying, well, you know, we allow all these lines of thought, whatever you're thinking, free speech, First Amendment, where other social media platforms are saying, no, it is our responsibility. We are almost like publishers and we need to police it. The reason why this is an ongoing conversation with social media outlets is because it costs money to police it. And also, if you're turning down ads from politicians, mm-hmm. it also means that you lose a certain amount of revenue, even though Mark Zuckerberg says it isn't that much. Facebook gets a lot more revenue from politicians and political ads than Twitter does.
Well, Facebook is not cracking down on political ads, but it is cracking down on something else, the use of certain emojis that it says lead to sexual harassment. The company recently updated its community standards to make both Facebook and Instagram, which is owned by Facebook, safer for women, and in doing so will ban the use of the eggplant and peach emoji alongside an implicit or indirect ask for nude imagery, sex, sexual partners, or sex chat, and violation of this could result in the removal of somebody's account. What are people saying about this?
You're reading that very carefully because I know you don't want to get into trouble here. So there is context that is very, very important. So you may want to use the peach or eggplant, hot dogs, the OK sign, baguettes. There are so many suggestive emojis out there. You are not being banned from using that, so don't worry about that. If you're going shopping and you're doing your shopping, you're fine. If you're putting together a very creative, suggestive, heartwarming weekend string of emojis, you can do that as well. But what you cannot do is solicit for any sexual activities and put those emojis together. You are not allowed to do that. So there is pushback, and the pushback comes from sex workers who say we use social media the same way other businesses use social media. It is our business. And if we can't use these particular emojis, they're not sexual emojis, it's just that we're extremely creative about how we use icons on social. They are saying that it will impact their business as well as perhaps stopping people from using these social platforms as ways of offering sex. Basically.
Well, I don't want to make too much light of this because maybe it is serious for some people, but I'm just trying to imagine
it's
the
funny.
Person who posts on Facebook that they're going shopping for an eggplant and a peach and they think that...
and then their account is suspended.
Right, then their account will be suspended.
You will be fine. You can go shopping. You can use all those emojis. You can even be quite naughty with those emojis. You cannot ask or even hint that those emojis are connected with any sexual solicitation. I think that covers most people out there.
Okay, Femi, I've only got 30 seconds left for you to talk about the dog, which is President Trump tweeted a photo of him draping a medal around the neck of a military dog with the caption, American hero. Twitter's going nuts. What is this about?
Because the tweet was a Photoshop. It was not a very good Photoshop, and it was actually a joke. So the president tweeted out a joke from another media publication. Everybody realized it was a joke. Perhaps the president didn't. And then he corrected it the day after and said that the declassified dog, who is now called Conan, he's declassified completely, will be at the White House next week. So probably more social media declassified dog information to tell you in a few days' time.
And he's the one who found the ISIS leader. That is Femi Okay, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
I'm in London today where there is an election coming up next month, and President Trump did a little election interference yesterday, calling into a radio show and saying that Boris Johnson's Brexit deal will make it difficult for the U.S. to cut a free trade deal with the U.K. The show was hosted by Brexit Party founder Nigel Farage, who made some news of his own today. NPR London correspondent Frank Langfitt is here with me in the studio now in London. Frank, it's great to see you in person.
Welcome back, Jeremy.
Well, thank you. And there's been a lot of news this week, but let's get to what happened today. Nigel Farage making some news of his own.
Yeah, he's basically saying to Boris Johnson, I can help you win a majority in Parliament on December 12th when they have the big vote here. And what he's basically saying to Johnson is, let's split up the territory. I will pull my people out of your where you have Tory seats. I'll go after Labour. I'll try to win them and we'll run as a coalition. But he said in order to do that, Boris Johnson has to kill his withdrawal agreement that he's been working incredibly hard to get.
Which was very hard to
pass
through Parliament.
It was, yeah. And so the idea that you would do this makes no sense, I think, to Boris Johnson. So I don't know exactly where this is going. But the threat is, if not, Nigel Farage would run in Tory seats and would split the vote and maybe the Remain side of Labour and other parties could win.
And this is because Nigel Farage, who, by the way, his party has zero seats in Parliament right now.
It's a new party.
It's a new party. And he believes that Boris Johnson's Brexit deal is too soft of a Brexit.
What he is arguing for is a no-deal Brexit, walking away without a withdrawal agreement that every economist you talk to practically says would no doubt damage this economy considerably.
But there are people in this country who think that that's a good idea.
There are people in this country absolutely who feel that.
And you've got the two major parties, the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, that are kind of split on the issue of Brexit. So there is an opportunity for somebody like Nigel Farage to come along and say, well, I'm going to give you leave the way you want it.
Yeah, and there is a constituency, but I don't think it's a very large one, which is what it seems to be right now is Johnson not going for this or willing to deal with Nigel Farage, which suggests he's confident that he can do this on his own.
Now, this is connected to what happened yesterday, which was that President Trump called in to Nigel Farage's radio show, which is unheard of. For the president of the United States to involve himself in an election, especially at this early stage, in another country. And he said not only that he thinks that the opposition leader, Jeremy Corbyn, would be so bad for – those are his words – for the UK, but he also said that he doesn't think that the deal that Boris Johnson struck with the EU is going to be good either. What did he say?
Oh, what he said, basically, he didn't explain exactly why, Jeremy, but the important thing is he was not supportive of Boris Johnson's deal. So this hurts Boris Johnson. I mean, one of the things that Johnson and the other Brexiteers have been saying since this campaign started back in 2016 for the referendum is we're going to be unshackled from all of the bureaucrats and all of these regulations from the European Union. We're going to go out and we're going to strike these great free trade deals that are going to make us richer with, of course, the United States. Now you have the president of the United States saying, I don't like what I see here.
Which would be interesting if Jeremy Corbyn ends up being the next prime minister and then has to work with President Trump.
I can't imagine what that would be like.
Okay. I want to ask you, Frank, while we have you here, you just got back from Northern Ireland, which has been at the center of the debate over Brexit because Northern Ireland is part of the UK and the Republic of Ireland would still be part of the EU after Brexit. They've been trying to figure out the border issues. What did you find in Northern Ireland?
Well, it was really interesting. The Brexit withdrawal agreement that we were just talking about, Jeremy, basically to kind of simplify it for people in the States, it draws a border down the Irish Sea. And what this means is after Brexit, what would happen is there would be customs arrangements so that if you were in Northern Ireland and you're a business, you might have to pay customs tariffs for products that are coming over because those products could in fact go into the EU. So the EU wants somebody because there's not going to be a border between Northern Ireland and Ireland. Well, first of all, businesses don't like this. I was talking to a tailor who said, I don't have the people to do this admin for me. I'm going to do more work with Ireland. Mm-hmm. Other people, unionists in Northern Ireland who love the United Kingdom, love the Queen, feel like they're being betrayed by Boris Johnson. That like, oh, now there's going to be this distance, this division between us.
It's sort of like if you had to go through customs to take something from Hawaii to California.
Or I think even – yeah. I mean, I think that's one way. I mean, imagine how Hawaiians would feel if they were collecting taxes and tariffs for another country from something that's coming from the States. You can understand they wouldn't like this.
So you think that people are very frustrated with this. Do you sense violence? Because there's been a history of violence.
There is. And I think for the first time – I've been going to Belfast for a number of years now, and it's the first time I really felt considerable tension. And unionists are very unhappy about this. There is talk of some potential return to violence, not big violence, and people don't even want to talk that way. But Jeremy, I got to say, it felt different in a way than it ever has in my trips to Belfast.
Well, we look forward to your reporting on that. Frank, NPR's Frank Langfitt, London correspondent here with me in London today. Great to see you. Thanks.
Happy to do it, man.
Well, let's get a view from the Republic of Ireland now. We're joined by Pat Leahy, political editor for the Irish Times. He's in Dublin. Hi, Pat.
Good to be here.
Well, how is the news of the general election and the Brexit extension being viewed in Ireland?
No country has followed the trials and tribulations of the British debate on Brexit more closely than Ireland has. So you can be pretty sure that people here, both in government circles, of course, but also in the wider public, are following the election campaign very closely. We get all the British channels, we get all their newspapers and magazines. So Irish people are much more attuned to British public debate in a way that is clearly not reciprocated. Everybody's watching it here.
If the Conservatives end up winning a majority in Parliament, then Boris Johnson's deal would look very likely to go through, which would, as we just heard from Frank, essentially create a border in the Irish Sea. How does Ireland think about that?
Ireland's not crazy about a border in the Irish Sea at all, but it prefers it to be in the Irish Sea than across the island of Ireland. Mm-hmm. Our management of Brexit, the Irish government's management of Brexit, has always been an exercise in damage limitation. If the UK is to leave the customs union and the single market, then there has to be a border between the UK and the EU. So that border either goes across the island of Ireland or it goes in the Irish Sea. So I think while there is significant concern about the economic effect on Ireland, I think the government is happy and most people appear to be satisfied that the nightmare scenario of a border in Ireland, a re-hardening of the Irish border, has been avoided.
Well, so let me take that a step further then. Do you think that if there is essentially a border in the Irish Sea, that Ireland and Northern Ireland are moving closer eventually to reunification?
I think that's a very delicate subject, and it's very sensitive at the moment for unionists who, for perfectly understandable reasons, are feeling that they have been separated, or they will be separated to some degree from the rest of the UK. Unionists are anxious about that. They're anxious about the constitutional implications. So I think that is a dynamic that is only beginning to assert itself, because the great fear of the Irish government was, were there to be a hardening of the border on the island of Ireland, mm-hmm. that you would have a threat of a return to violence on behalf of mm-hmm. some Republican dissidents. Now the question comes, I suppose, on the other side of the ledger, on the loyalist and unionist side, as to what effect a hardening of the border or an establishment of an economic border down the Irish Sea has on them.
In some ways, you could say that Brexit has actually been good for Ireland, because you've seen firms and companies flowing out of London and setting up shop in Dublin. In fact, the Irish Times has been counting the cranes visible outside your windows. What are you seeing there in terms of the positive side for Ireland?
I mean, this is something that is touted occasionally as an opportunity for Ireland from Brexit, and there is an extent to which that is going on. Mm-hmm. I think that is, whatever opportunities are there for Ireland as a result of Brexit will be outweighed by the economic costs of Brexit, by the increased barriers between Ireland and the UK, which remains not our largest anymore, but certainly a very, very important trading partner for Ireland.
Let me just finally ask you, are you seeing, amid all of the Brexit uncertainty, a lot of British people in Ireland, living in Ireland, trying to get their Irish passports, and vice versa? Are you seeing people who are Irish in the UK trying to get their British passports before any changes happen?
Certainly, there has been a huge increase in the number of British people seeking access to Irish passports. And of course, you must understand, there's been generations of inflows and outflows of people in both directions. But certainly, there are tens of thousands of people in the UK who have sought an Irish passport under the existing Irish rules, which mean that if you have a grandparent who was born in Ireland, you are entitled to an Irish passport. Mm-hmm. And the Department of Foreign Affairs, which is in charge of the issuance, reports massive increases in the numbers of UK people seeking to have an EU passport. One final point worth noting, I think, is that a common travel area will be maintained between Ireland and Great Britain. And that's been in existence almost since independence in 1922 mm-hmm. here, to facilitate the free movement of people between the two countries. There's a joint recognition of things like voting rights, social welfare, education, health and welfare rights and so forth. That will continue. Mm-hmm. Where there will be barriers is in terms of trade.
That is Pat Leahy, who is political editor at the Irish Times, joining us from Dublin. Pat, thank you.
My pleasure.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
There's more evidence of growth in the U.S. economy. The Labor Department reports today that employers added 128,000 jobs in October. Even so, the pace of hiring seems to be slowing from previous months. So with this phrase in mind, growing but slowing, let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. It doesn't apply to you, Mike.
Oh, thanks, Lisa.
I mean, it's a bit of a mixed bag, though. What do the numbers tell us about where the U.S. economy is headed now?
Well, one thing I would say about when you talk about jobs growth and the economy writ large, is jobs can tend to keep growing. These numbers can continue to look pretty good right up to the brink of a recession. And then during the recession is when they really sort of fall off the cliff. So that's why they, you know, on Wall Street, they call them a lagging indicator rather than a leading indicator. They tell us, you know, where we've been, but not necessarily where we're going. You know, that said, this number was better than expected. The economists we surveyed only expected 85,000 jobs to be added last month. So that this is a very positive surprise above that. And the prior 2 months were revised quite a bit higher. So about 95,000 more jobs were added in those previous 2 months, August and September, than what we previously believed.
Which parts of the job sector gained the most?
One of the real standouts was actually, you know, basically bars and restaurants. They added about 48,000 jobs. But there were other sectors that showed pretty decent growth. The real broad professional and business services category added about 22,000 jobs. Financial activities actually rose by 16,000. A lot of real estate jobs and leasing and credit jobs added in that sector. One interesting one was social assistance actually increased by 20,000 jobs. A lot of that was individual and family services, what they called. So that was certainly an area of growth in October.
The United Auto Workers strike against General Motors lasted 40 days. It's over now. How did that strike depress the manufacturing center?
It certainly weighed on these numbers quite a bit. I think about 41,000 jobs were removed from the equation because of the GM strike. So that partly explains why the number looks like growth is slowing. But if you look at the growth over the past 6 months, if you average it out over that time period, it's clear that we are in a bit of a slowing growth trend. Over those 6 months, it's been about 150,000 jobs added per month on average. Over the 5 years since 2014, the average is closer to 200,000. So we're still adding jobs, but the pace is slowing a little bit. And there's a couple factors that could be behind that. For one thing, the unemployment rate is so low that some companies are struggling to find the right workers they want to add. But there are signs that some parts of the economy are slowing, and there may be reluctance on companies to add more jobs because of that.
And finally, the GDP grew at an annualized pace of 1.9% in the third quarter. President Trump had talked about 3%. How much is the trade war weighing down the economy?
It's hard to say exactly, but it certainly is weighing it down to some degree, especially that manufacturing sector of the economy. It's not a huge sector of the economy, but it really has been in a slump for 3 months now. The Institute for Supply Management just came out today with a report showing that for a third straight month, that sector has actually shrank rather than grew. So the concern is when and if that really starts to infect the broader services sector of the economy.
Mike Regan, thank you.
Continuing our Brexit coverage today from the BBC in London, and an important part of this story is taking place far away from where we are. A new study shows migration from Britain to other European countries is at a 10-year high. Here in Now's Peter O'Dowd met up with some Brits in Berlin who left the UK after the country voted to split with Europe.
One of them is Chris Ward, who ran a campaign event in his London apartment the night British voters made history.
To me, my heart left the United Kingdom on the 23rd of June, 2016.
Clearly, the vote did not go his way.
You say your heart left.
Yeah.
Are you heartbroken?
I was.
So Ward and his boyfriend moved to Berlin, got married, and Ward found a job in software development.
It's a wonderfully liberal city. It's a very opening, welcoming, and largely safe city.
And do you consider it home now? Do you feel like you have a home?
And yes, this is home. This is where I want to live. I'm working towards citizenship here, at which point I have to surrender my British citizenship, and I'm fine with that.
You
know? Yeah, to me, I'm European, and I consider myself, even if not by paper, German.
By the way, it's a funny term, but you're now part of the Brexitus, I guess they call it.
The Brexitus, yeah. And there are quite a lot of us.
Indeed, there are. A new study by Oxford in Berlin predicts 84,000 Brits will move to other EU countries this year. And the number of Brits receiving German citizenship rose from 622 the year before Brexit to 7,500 the year after.
Many officials now in the German authorities predict that it's going to be far higher this coming year, and that includes me, who just got citizenship 3 days ago.
Daniel Tetlow was born in the UK and is one of the study's authors. He says people raced to get their paperwork finalized before the end of October, when Britain had been set to leave the EU. The rules will get stricter after Brexit is final, and that could threaten work status and freedom to travel.
People are taking risks, I think, as a reaction to this level of uncertainty that they've had to live through for 3 years. People cannot stand this level of uncertainty.
And it is a big decision to change citizenship or move across the continent.
Nächste Station, Gesundbrunnen. Dort haben Sie Anschlussmöglichkeiten.
A 30-minute train ride northeast of Berlin is a town called Eberswalde.
I'm Magda Sikora.
Hi, I'm Samah Abdallah. I'm British and Magda's husband.
Magda and Sama decided to move here 2 days after the vote. Magda is Polish. It's one reason they left so quickly.
A lot of the Brexit rhetoric was about, you know, there are too many Eastern Europeans here.
Life is pretty good. They like living near the woods in a smaller town. They spend more time with their 5-year-old daughter. But it's been 3 years now, and Ach du Liebe, the language.
I don't really know if we could have prepared ourselves for that.
Yes, the language is an issue.
You struggle with German.
Yeah, well, I keep learning and I think I'm doing pretty well. But still, I mean, I'm a social scientist. I mean, in order to be able to work in my occupation, I really have to be near native level. Yeah. So it will take some time. I've taken some sacrifices in terms of my career and my occupation. I feel like I'm on pause at the moment.
It's interesting for me to hear that you have some trouble with German, because we're very close to the Polish border, just a few kilometers away. So it sounds like you're saying you don't feel like home completely here.
Oh, no. I mean, in terms of cultural differences, I felt much more at home in Britain than I do here.
In fact, Sama still feels British, and he knows his daughter will not the longer they stay.
And somehow that feels quite strange, feeling that our daughter is going to be German.
And someday he could be too, if he's willing to give up his British passport and apply for German citizenship.
I wouldn't want to have to make that decision now.
Even though you left, you still have it in your heart a little bit, it sounds like.
I do feel like when you take citizenship, you do somehow have to somehow feel like you really do belong in that place, and that you are, you know, I can't imagine myself saying I am German. So ich bin Deutsch.
And that is how life after Brexit plays out in this German town. A little messy and not exactly as planned.
And Peter joins me now from Berlin. Peter, it is interesting to hear from those people, because we've been talking about how Brexit is all about national identity. But as we hear there, it is very personal for people. It's about their own personal identity.
It is very much personal for people, and that's one of my main takeaways from this week in Germany, is that for many people, Brexit has already happened. You can say all you want to about what's going to happen in January, what's going to happen with the election, general election in the United Kingdom in December, but for so many people that doesn't matter. It's irrelevant, because their lives have already changed so much because of this 3-year drag that is Brexit.
You know, it's interesting to hear that, because here it very much has not happened yet. And we've heard from people who want it to happen, who say, let's just get on with it. You know, this is what we voted for. You have to respect the will of the people, make it happen. And then you also hear from others. I spoke to a friend here the other day who voted to remain in the referendum. And I said, well, what about that? What about people who said, we voted to leave, let us leave? And he said, well, you know, it's kind of like if I were to give you a choice of, do you want an apple or an orange? And you said, I want an apple. And then after that, they said, well, okay, just so you know, the apple has a rotten core and it's got a worm inside of it. And you say, well, actually, I don't want the apple anymore. And then they say, well, I'm sorry, you already voted for the apple. That's how some people here feel.
Yeah, well, you know, there is no all the fruit is rotten in terms of the perspective from Germany. Nobody wants to leave, and I say nobody. Europe is so vastly popular on the continent and in Germany. I found one politician, a far-right politician, who we heard from earlier in the week, who said, yes, it's time to leave. But you speak to people here, Jeremy, they think this is the craziest idea, and they have no idea what is going on in London with all this chaos that we've been reporting on over the last couple of days. They're just scratching their heads over here.
Well, and I will say that, you know, it is certainly a topic of conversation everywhere that I go, especially now that we've got this election coming up in December on the 12th in the UK. Nobody really knows what's going to happen in that. Boris Johnson's Conservative Party has the lead in the polls right now, but Nigel Farage, as we've been talking about, kind of threw a wrench into that today. Maybe. We'll see. But at the same time, Peter, there are other stories that are part of the conversation here right now. There was a big report that just came out about the Grenfell Tower fire. You remember that big apartment tower in London, that there was a terrible fire. Many people died. A report came out about that. People also talking about that truck that was discovered with more than 30 bodies in the back, human trafficking going on, which has also tied into the Brexit story. I wonder, what are people talking about in Germany other than Brexit?
Sure. Well, I am standing right now between the Bundestag, the German parliament, and the Brandenburg Gate. This is this famous symbol of both unity, frankly, and division in this city. It's where President Ronald Reagan famously challenged Mikhail Gorbachev to tear down this wall. The 30th anniversary of the Berlin Wall coming down is next week. It's on November 9th. And in front of me right now, you wouldn't even believe how big the stage is that they're constructing in front of the Brandenburg Gate. And it is because there's going to be a big week of festivities coming up here in the next few days to celebrate that monumental moment. And the Brandenburg Gate, the plaza in front of it, of course, is where so many famous things have happened in German history. Not to mention, that's where all those Germans gathered to celebrate the victory of the World Cup a few years ago.
Well, and I remember being in that square there at Brandenburg Gate, and there are the four embassies that represented the powers that sort of ran the world.
Yes.
During the Cold War. Let me just ask you one final thing, Peter. We always like to end things on food, and I've had some great Indian food here in the UK. Have you been having, currywurst or schnitzel while you've been in Germany?
I couldn't bring myself to do the currywurst, and I don't know why, but the schnitzel, yes, I have, because how could you refuse fried meat with a fried egg on top of it? I've also been enjoying some goulash, which I, never would order in the United States, but, when in Berlin. And I have to say, they serve beer by the liter here. Now, I don't want people to get worried about me, but I accidentally ordered a giant beer, and I had to do something with it.
They serve it by the pint here. That is Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd, who's been reporting this week from Berlin, Germany, getting the view from mainland Europe as we've been reporting from London about Brexit. Peter, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
And you can find all of our reporting about Brexit at hereandnow.org.
Boeing chief executive Dennis Muilenburg faced questions on Capitol Hill this week about the two crashes of Boeing 737 MAX jets that killed 346 people.
We are deeply, deeply sorry. And we'll never forget. And I want you to know that. And we're committed to making the improvements that we need to make.
So there were apologies, but also revelations that Boeing employees had raised flags about the plane's flight control system that's now partly blamed for the crashes. Andy Pastor is reporter with the Wall Street Journal. Andy, what were your takeaways from the week?
So I think the hearings were emotional and also substantive. And we finally have a face to this crisis. It's really amazing that it's been a year since the first 737 MAX went down. And since then, it's taken this long to get some of these details out about the problems and mistakes inside Boeing. It really has been only in the last couple of months, and especially at these hearings where you had now a face for this crisis, the chairman, Dennis Muilenburg, actually apologizing, acknowledging that they made mistakes, and saying he should have reached out to the families, and also saying that if they had to do it again, they certainly wouldn't have done what they did.
In terms of the detail that came out this week, some of the documents particularly showed that Boeing employees were concerned about this control system long before the crashes. What issues were raised?
The issues had to do with the number of sensors used on this flight control system. So if you had only one sensor, which is what ended up with the Boeing design, if that sensor malfunctioned, was hit by a bird, or somehow in some other way wouldn't operate properly, this whole system would not operate as expected. And in fact, what occurred was there were a number of alerts and alarms, some of them contradictory and some of them very puzzling to the pilots. And Boeing has acknowledged now that they did not test for some of those more complicated and contradictory reactions if there was a problem. Boeing assumed that pilots would be able to react quickly within 4 seconds and effectively to that emergency. And there were repeated questions on the Hill, really, where lawmakers were amazed and basically kept saying, how could you devise a system that relied on the pilots as the backup and relied on them to react in 4 seconds if you knew that these sensors could malfunction and if you knew that the malfunction could cause such catastrophic and complicated results?
And what was the response?
That's the way we've done things. These are industry standards, number one. Number two, the FAA let us do it. That's basically the response.
I mean, it is mind-boggling when one thinks not just, of course, of the loss of life, but also the financial burden that Boeing has had to take as a result of this. I mean, was there any sense made of how they could take these kind of risks?
No, because they would say that they calculated the issues and determined that the risks were not at such a high point. It has cost them many billions. It will cost them many billions of more. It has been the, as someone told me, the nadir of their reputation throughout their modern history. And in fact, it's created a huge problem of trust among lawmakers at the FAA and certainly among passengers. A lack of candor has shown throughout these months.
So that's Boeing's role. What about the FAA culpability? The FAA has outsourced a lot of its certification process of new planes to the very companies that are making the planes. How is that being addressed?
Lawmakers from both parties in the past have approved what's called delegation, and that is to have company officials stand in for the FAA officials to approve the safety of systems. There's significant talk now about tightening oversight. The FAA, to some extent, simply doesn't have the manpower and the expertise to do many of the things that they should do and are trying to do. So some of it is just out of necessity, and some of it in these cases where they didn't have the wherewithal to carefully analyze which systems and what part of systems they need to look at carefully. The FAA needs to be rigorous and much more rigorous in looking at than they have been. And that may be improved, perhaps, with some additional legislation, which Boeing has not at this point agreed to. They've been very ambivalent and reluctant to commit to any specific changes.
Would you ever feel safe getting on a Boeing 737 MAX because Boeing wants to put it back in the air when it can?
That's, of course, the big question. I would say that safety experts that I trust say that this will be the most scrutinized aircraft in history. They have gone through a safety scrub and gone into some arcane areas of the flight control system and the flight control computers and pilot reaction that they've never done before, basically, for any aircraft. So in that sense, I think people can rest assured that there's been a significant amount of additional work done way beyond what was originally done. But it's not so much what I think. The airlines themselves are very concerned about putting these planes back into service in terms of how quickly they want to do it, and they want to avoid, of course, any problems. So it will take many months until we have a sense whether the average passenger will care about whether it's a MAX or just any kind of other 737.
Andy Pastor, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, nice to speak with you. Thank you.
My pleasure to be with you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.